Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and it's good to be here live taping from Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's Restaurant. If you don't tune in live, you can always find past episodes of In the Drink on www.heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes, where all the episodes are archived. I'm extremely excited today to bring to the show someone who I have worked with professionally as someone who's bought quite a bit of wine from him for the last, about 8 years or so, and then have also sparked up a friendship over the years with Mr. Doug Polliner. He brings in, he's the vendor of such extraordinary wines that we are really proud to serve at our restaurants. Wines, famous names such as Giuseppe Mascarello and Giacomo Conterno, and Prevost Champagne, Litterai, Arno Roberts, Huet. The list goes on and on and on. And then real kind of up and comers that you're seeing around all the place. One of our staff favorite wines at all the restaurants is this small producer Mount Etna called Calabretta that we see at all of the restaurants. And anytime the stock runs low or vintage changes, there's a collective sigh from the staff because they're all such big fans. Anyway, Doug, I am a big fan of yours. Welcome to In the Drink. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Joe. It's a pleasure.
So tell us how, I know that you, prior to starting your own company, you worked for many years as a wine salesperson, a challenging job to say the least, trying to get the wine buyers of New York to purchase your wine. There's so many different options. How did you decide to start your own company? How did that come about?
Well, it's an interesting story. You know, I started in the wine business in 1991, and you know, that was the dark ages compared to now in a lot of ways. Obviously a lot fewer companies, but you know, it was good. I cut my teeth working for a company that no longer exists called Excelsior. And then in 93, I joined Michael Skernick Wines. And that was the early days of that company as well. I was their third sales rep. And my territory was the entire state of New York and the entire state of New Jersey, except for Manhattan and Long Island. So needless to say, I did a lot of driving. It was a great experience. I learned a lot. I worked with them for 6 years, starting as a salesperson and then kind of working more in their office and getting involved in buying and sourcing and things like that. But when it got to the end of the 90s, I was kind of trying to think about, you know, what I wanted to do, considered kind of staying on in a more official status with them. And I decided, you know, I was about to get married, and my wife and I said, you know, if there's ever a time to try and take a chance and start a business, you know, now is the time. So we started in 1999, and I think the most interesting thing was, you know, when you start out again, you think like, oh yeah, I know all these people, I'm just gonna be able to walk in, and everyone's gonna like, you know, open up their doors and say, hey, let me taste what you're showing and let me buy. And you know what happens is you get to the back of the line and you know, you have to start and you have to prove yourself. Wow. Again and again and
so
again.
What did you find was more challenging in those early days, getting the producers to sign on with a new someone new who they've never heard of before, or getting the buyers to bite once you already had that wine?
You know, really, it was a little of both, Joe. You know, in a lot of ways, I think back to those days, you know, when you'd go and you'd meet with producers and you'd say, hey, you know, have faith in me. You know, we have no track record, but, you know, it's all going to be good. And, you know, a lot of people came on board early on. And, you know, we were able to put together, you know, an interesting portfolio. You know, I felt like in order to be successful, you know, there were already lots of competitors out there. You know, we needed to be relevant. We needed to stand out in a certain way. We needed to differentiate. And so, you know, we really tried to put together, you know, an interesting sort of ahead of its time portfolio. And it's kind of been the guiding light, you know, ever since. You know, the market's even more crowded now.
Were there a couple of producers at that time where a kind of wine insiders knew about them and people would smuggle the bottles back in their suitcase when they went to Europe, but they weren't important? You're like, I'm going to go out and get them.
Well, you know, the whole Piedmont thing had been a passion. You know, I had already been going there every year in November. It's a perfect time to go, as you well know. There's other things to do besides just taste wine, eat white truffles. So I'd been going for a long time. You know, I'd been visiting a lot of these producers. I was visiting Roberto Conterno. I was visiting Mauro Mascarello. And so, you know, these were people that I already had relationships with. Even before we started our business. And so that kind of kept going. And they knew that, you know, we were super passionate about the category. It was sort of when traditional Barolo, what people were sort of rediscovering it. And so, you know, it was ahead of its time to kind of get back into those wines. I mean, when we first started with those guys, you know, you could buy whatever you wanted. You know, it wasn't like, oh, here's your allocation. You know, it was like, well, how much Cascina Francia do you want? You know, how much Montprovado do you want? Obviously now it's like, here's your allotment, you know, pick it up by such and such a date or forget it. You know, someone else will pick it up. So definitely the times have changed.
Yeah, and even as us wine buyers now, just looking at our Bartolo Mascarello allocations are so minuscule. This is actually, having you on the show is actually my personal attempt to lobby you to increase the amount of Bartolo Mascarello that Dell'Anima can buy.
I wish I could. I wish she would buy more land. It's funny because, you know, you talk to Maria Teresa and she's a sweetheart, you know, and people are always like, well, why don't you just, you know, you're 5 hectares. That's nothing. Why don't you, you know, buy more land? She's like, yeah, people offer me, you know, these beautiful vineyards. And I'm like, I'm not really interested. You know, I like the size of what I do. She loves kind of that attachment to the past. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, at that winery, you go there on a weekend, like on a Sunday or a Saturday in the middle of November. And there are people like who were coming and who buy wine every year. And they sit and chatting with her for hours, you know, to buy their 3 bottles of wine, you know, but that's how it always was. And so, you know, she wants to kind of hold on to that. And obviously, you know, she could blink her eyes and sell all her wine and go on vacation for the next year. But, you know, that's, she wants it kind of the way it was. And wow. I think it's interesting and it's admirable.
And, you know, in that time in the 90s, when you were making that transition to starting your own company, it's kind of tumultuous times in Piedmont, right? There's a huge divide that I think maybe in some ways has lessened now between people who are going one way with their style of wine production and people going with the other way. And it seems that you've kind of firmly planted the producers that you go for in the more traditional kind of bent. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would say so. And, you know, I kind of came of age in the wine business selling the Marc de Grazia portfolio. So, you know, those were sort of my reference points. And I remember buying and cellaring a lot of those wines and sort of thinking, wow, this is, you know, really interesting. It's a whole new paradigm. It's Barolo that's approachable. And then I remember kind of towards the end of the 90s, I had a good friend, this guy, Tim Wilson, who had worked for Rosenthal, worked a little for Skernik. He was a buyer. He was super passionate about the traditional wines. And I remember we did a series of tastings of wines kind of from the late 80s and early 90s, examples of kind of the great modernists and the great traditionalists. And it was in these tastings that kind of the light went on, like, wow, like Barolo is Barolo because, you know, it's been made a certain way. And, you know, while the modern wines kind of were a little cleaner, maybe, the Barolos, like traditional wines, just kind of spoke to you. And in a different way, and were really soulful and just beautiful. And from that point on, I was like, this is really where it's at. And I think what's interesting is you see, you know, producers, apparently like Scavino now has like gotten rid of all their barriques, and they're aging everything in Boti. And so, you know, I think a lot of those people have come around, not all of them. But you know, I think that the interest, as you see, is definitely in the traditional wines. I mean, mm-hmm. Barolo made traditionally, there's just nothing else that's like it. You know, okay. It's absolutely nothing. You know, Barolo made like Napa Valley Cabernet, you know, it kind of tastes like a lot of other wines. So what I love about certain wines is that they're unique, you know, especially with a varietal like Nebbiolo, which, you know, there's Nebbiolo grown in many, many places, but, you know, there really is only one Barolo, one Barbaresco, and those wines are
singular. I mean, I'm with you, and I totally share your passion for Barolo and especially the more traditional wines from Barolo. Do you find that on your trips there, the conversation has shifted to something else? I feel like, you know, you obviously, you visit Piedmont more than I do, and you're more in touch, I think, with some of the producers, but I feel like the conversation that I've heard has now been kind of moving more towards the vineyard, where before it was a little bit more about vinification. Now people are, even the more modernist style producers or the riper style producers are at least trying to be a little bit more gentle and green in the vineyard.
I think so. I think everybody who is pretty much who's making quality wine today is really thinking about the whole viticulture aspect, because, you know, winemaking is kind of a series of hundreds, if not thousands, of tiny little decisions that you make along the way. And each of those decisions can impact either positively or negatively the ultimate quality of the wine. And what's amazing is to taste wines where, you know, a producer's made significant progress in the viticulture, and the changes in the actual wine that come from that are just remarkable, and they're not subtle changes. They're big changes. And what's amazing is that, you know, that I think that people are realizing that this is an opportunity to really raise the bar, mm-hmm. In terms of quality, is to really focus on the vineyard, to get the vineyard in balance, to not stress it, to not over chemicalize it. And that is a way to increase your quality, because, you know, if you focused on all the other things, you focused on everything in the cellar, your cellar's meticulous, you got to find another area to tweak it just a little bit to make your wines a little better.
Yeah, well, now let's shift to another one of your passions is champagne. This is kind of an area that historically it's been known to kind of absolutely brutalize their vineyards. It's probably some of the most egregious bad farming, but there's also a green movement in Champagne. Is that accurate? I mean, it's the story that I've read. I've actually never visited Champagne, to full disclosure, but what I've heard from so many people is you used to go to vineyards in Champagne and you could find Paris garbage in the vineyards and that sort of thing, and the soils were just completely dead. And now I know some of the producers that you work with are not doing that sort of thing, and that's revolutionary in a way.
It is. I mean, Champagne was definitely a poster child for horrible chemical viticulture for a long time, and I think that a few more progressive producers have definitely started a trend towards more natural viticulture, more natural winemaking, and I think are making, you know, some of the most exciting wines.
And do you find that it's even you can tell even through all the winemaking that goes into Champagne, the two fermentations and the extended aging on the lees and the disgorgement and all this stuff, you can still tell the difference between a producer who has been a good carer of the environment?
It's an interesting story. We're starting with a really fantastic small producer called La Herte.
Again, La Herte.
Yeah.
Wow, I love those.
You heard it here. The wines are en route, be here soon. Fantastic wines. And what's interesting, I was there a couple months ago and tasted two champagnes. They make a Blanc de Blanc Brut Nature from their vineyards near, in and around Chaveau, which mm-hmm. is where they are. And they recently took over some vineyards from a family, a cousin or whatever, in the Côte de Blanc, in Avize, Grand Cru. And what's interesting is you taste the two wines side by side and you think, oh, wow, you know, the Grand Cru wine should like smoke it. And in fact, it's the opposite. And the reason is because the Grand Cru wine from Aviz was farmed, you know, with chemicals. And he comes right out. He's like, look, we're starting to do the work. But, you know, this is the first example. So here you have what's, I think, a very good terroir, but maybe not the 100% Grand Cru best terroir, where the viticulture trumps the pedigree of the vineyard. And night and day, not even close.
Wow. I mean, those are wines that I already like, and so it'll be really exciting to see how they improve with the improved viticulture. But on that note, we're going to take just a very quick break, and we'll be back with more with Doug Polliner from Polliner Selections after this.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, we are back on In the Drink with Doug Polliner of Polliner Selections. And, God, just during the break, I was kind of going through my racking my brain of all the great champagne producers that you guys have. It's kind of like the, you know, the Lartuzzi champagne selection is mostly from you guys that I'm thinking about. But whether it's Cedric Bouchard, Marie Cortin, Solos, Lermandier Bernier, now La Herte, Christophe Mignon, so many like outstanding champagne producers, and all or mostly they're grower producers, right?
Yes.
Is that something that is a true passion of yours, grower producers? Do you feel like there's a certain difference? I know I just love the idea of someone who is growing their own grapes and trying to express a terroir, especially in Champagne, as I said before, it's such a manufactured product by a person, right? I feel like these are the best expressions of terroir in the Champagne region.
Well, yeah, well. You know, I think Champagne is super, super exciting region-wide right now. And it's not just the producers that we have. I mean, I drink lots of other great small producers as well. I mean, we drink a lot of Champagne at home. For us, it's probably our favorite white wine. I don't know, it's kind of become a little bit of a problem, but we drink a lot of champagne. So we taste a lot, and I go there fairly often, and it's exciting. It's exciting to be a part of this kind of emerging trend. And as we were talking about on the break, you know, I think that what the story was in the 90s about grower. If you're a grower, you're good because you're small and you're making your wine from a particular village versus blending it from all over Champagne, which is in general what, you know, the Grand Marks did. That was an interesting dialogue. I think it opened a lot of people's minds to, you know, kind of a new paradigm in Champagne. But I think that now it's kind of gone even further. It's more precise viticulture. It's less about blending. It's about taking a specific vineyard or vineyard, a specific terroir, doing like single vintage, single vineyard wines where it's a snapshot. It's more like a wine. It's a snapshot of that wine from that vineyard. So next year, you know, it's going to be different, but that's what makes wine great. You know, it's got a different, slightly different character. So a lot of the guys that we work with are kind of working in this paradigm, and the champagnes are just super, super exciting. They're very precise. They tend to be a little bit more dry in style. I think the market's kind of going towards a bit drier in style. My palate certainly is, towards, you know, extra brut and even brut nature wines. But in order to make those wines, it requires, you know, a huge amount of work on the viticulture side to have something that, you know, can just be pure and on its own.
Right. It seems like there needs to be enough density and complexity of the fruit itself to compensate for having no sugar in champagne, which is such a high acid sort of wine. And I just love the way that you describe it as a white wine as opposed to a sparkling wine, because that's also how I like to treat them. We pour them in white wine glasses unless a guest requests a flute. And I think that these are expressive white wines that should be treated as such.
Absolutely. They really, really are. And I think it's great that you serve them in white wine glasses. And the problem with champagne is that for the longest time, people kind of threw it in the category of, oh, it's what you drink to have a celebration or around the holidays and stuff like that. And rather than pigeonholing it into that, I think you're missing out on really one of the great white wines, yeah, we're talking about, that can go with so many, many different things. And now there's, you know, so many different styles. This uber crisp Blanc de Blancs, and then there's Pinot Noirs that have body and weight but still good cut. There's kind of these Venice Rosé champagnes that are like totally awesome that you could drink with steak. You know, I mean, the whole notion of champagne kind of being something that you could have throughout the meal, I think it's absolutely true.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, now that we've covered the classics of Barolo and champagne, I'd love to move the conversation towards some more up-and-coming wines, and certainly the topic that is been a hot button topic for a number of years now, though, natural wines. How does the natural wine market affect what you do? Is it something that you even contemplate when making decisions about finding producers? What are your thoughts on natural wines?
It's an interesting subject. You know, I mean, we have a lot of natural wines. We have a lot of producers who are really at the forefront of natural, organic, and biodynamic viticulture. I guess where I have an issue is kind of how the whole thing has become a little dogmatic, and people go to the extremes. And I think as a result, in some circles, there's this idea that, you know, if it's a natural wine, it's gotta look like a natural wine. It's gotta be a little funky. It's gotta be a little brown. But I think more and more people are kind of coming around to the idea that, you know, wine has to be, you know, clean. It has to taste like where it's from. And, you know, the notion of, there's an argument that, you know, if you don't add anything, you know, that's the ultimate expression of terroir. I would not agree with that. I think that that a little tiny dose of sulfur to give the wine a little precision will result in a wine that actually has a cleaner, more precise expression of the underlying terroir. Otherwise, you're tasting, you know, the process. You might as well age the wine in 100% new oak. That's another process, you know.
Is it almost the idea where you should taste the wine and you're like, oh, that's a delicious wine, I really like it, and then afterwards you find out, oh, this is a naturally made wine where they were good stewards of the land, and you like it even more because of that. Not that you go into it liking it because you know what they did in the vineyard or how they made the wine, and that kind of judges the way that you approach the wine.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's got to be a good wine. And more, I think we're seeing that those two things kind of go hand in hand. People are treating their vineyards better. Even people that are not officially organic, mm-hmm, you know, they're as close to organic as possible. It's sort of like, well, given the choice of losing my entire crop or, you know, adding a little something, people, you know, have to make the right decision. And, you know, but other than that, you know, they're organic and they realize it's important to, you know, not screw up your vineyards by, you know, throwing tons of chemicals in. I guess where my issue is that, you know, what I don't really understand is how some people feel like, you know, certain natural wines are kind of more natural than other people's natural wines. I mean, how could a wine like, you know, Houet or Domaine Lécu, those guys were on the forefront. They were, you know, farming organically in the 70s, farming biodynamically in the 80s. You know, well before it was like super popular. And there are some people that sort of dismiss them because, you know, the wines are clean and they're precise and they taste like, you know, their underlying terroirs. They add a little bit of sulfur at the bottling. I mean, to me, it's preposterous. I mean, those are great examples of great wines and great examples of
I will
of
take all their Muscadet and all their Houet all summer long, because those are definitely two of our household wines. I love both of them.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that the precision and the fruit, and it's so clean and beautiful and bright. I love both of those wines so much. And yeah, I mean, that's preposterous to me that anyone would say anything bad about either of those two wines.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's bad. It's just that, you know, they're not in the club, you know, right. And that's the other element. You know, a lot of the natural wine movement it's very much like a club. You go to these natural tastings in France and in Italy and stuff like that. And there's a bunch of, you know, guys running around with, you know, long hair and tattoos and showing their funky wines. And, you know, they're cool and hipster and, you know, but. Like at the end of the day, people actually have to drink the stuff, you know?
Like, yeah, and they have to sell it to people in the restaurant.
Exactly. So, you know, I kind of see, you know, maybe we're coming around, you know, the
All
other
right, well,
end.
So I want to ask you about orange wines then. How do you feel about orange wines? Do you think that an orange wine can possibly be a terroir-driven specific wine, or are only white wines that are made in a without skin maceration style? Yeah, are those the only white wines that can be enjoyable and fresh and lively and delicious?
I thought you weren't going to put me on the spot.
Sorry.
No.
I had to give you one hardball.
Absolutely. No. I think that those wines are they're terroir wines in the sense that a lot of those wines, you know, there's a historical context, you know, for why those wines are made the way they are, especially like the Friulian wines, which is kind of, you know, the epicenter for all that. You know, there's a history for making wines like that. And continuing the traditions, I think is a really important part of winemaking. I think those wines are really interesting. I think, you know, wine needs to have diversity. It really does. And, you know, I say that about, you know, funky wines. You know, I think it's okay that, you know, there's a reference of a funky wine. I think it's okay that there's orange wine. I mean, there's a place for a lot of stuff.
You're just not going to drink it.
See, I like orange wine, but, you know, for me, a glass or two is enough. Like to drink a whole bottle with two people of orange wine that's not where I would normally go. Give me a glass of champagne. I could drink a whole bottle of champagne.
Absolutely. I hear you. Absolutely. For me, I just to interject my opinion, I feel that since orange wine is so new for so many producers, people are still sorting it out. And there are producers who I think are quite adept at it. And there are producers who really are doing a horrible job with great intentions. And I think that the quality is going to continue to increase. But for me, the ones who are doing a really good job make some very compelling wines, like the Palo Bay Santa Chiara, for instance. That is, to me, it's not that funky of a wine. It's not really a funky wine.
And I think what those wines offer in terms of wine and food pairing, I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have this texture that you just can't get from a wine that's directly pressed. And I think, you know, all that extra texture, you know, I think can really interplay with lots of different foods. And so, you know, I think orange wine should have a place. I mean, to me, it's the ultimate kind of by the glass, you know, part of a tasting menu kind of thing that's married up like perfectly where a regular white wine wouldn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with you on that. And are there any other new producers or new regions that you're particularly excited about?
You know, I think that we've been involved in the Alto Piedmont region. I think that's a very, very exciting region. You know, Gamay,
yes, I
Gattinara,
love this producer, Pederino Gattinara, that you have. We have it at Alta Linea, and it's just and how you find these producers like them, like Trinchero, Calabretta, who release their wines late in Italy. It's just like we're able to offer at a very reasonable, approachable price. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it excites me quite a bit. Like Pettorino Gattinara, is less than $80 on our list. There's like for a 2001 vintage, an outstanding vintage that's over 14 years old, that has many of the characteristics of Barolo, but it's definitely its own specific, unique thing. It's just very exciting. And again, like Trincaro Barbera, I absolutely love those wines. And they cost, even maybe less than the Gattinara. And as I said before, Calabretta's on all of our lists. I couldn't imagine having an Italian wine list without their wines on it.
Yeah, well, I think it's great. People are really discovering that region just for that reason, because it's they're remarkable values.
Mm-hmm.
And with the story of Pettorino, it's like it's two brothers. They kind of have 2 hectares. They farm organically. They make some wine. They get around to bottling it eventually. It's not really, they're not looking to like make a killing on the stuff. But these things exist if you, turn over the rocks and you find them. And, I remember when we visited them the first time, we're looking around the cellar and there's a tank and it says 1996. And we said, well, what's that? And it's like, oh yeah, I got some 96, just haven't gotten around to bottling it. And that's just like, this is like 2 years ago, we're just like, well, can we buy some? And he's like, yeah, I guess so. I just got to get around to bottling. So, we bought the entire tank and, we started out with them. We had, some 1996 Gattinara. No, it was great.
It was outstanding. Oh. And then the one producer, we have to wrap up soon. Again, going back to Trincaro, we did a staff training with Trincaro. They came to Lartuzzi's, completely charmed and wooed the staff. And now anytime bring them up or tell the story about how they can no longer put their own name on their label, it just is absolutely mind-blowing to everyone.
Yeah, no, that was fascinating. I mean, I remember having these long conversations with Ezio Trincaro because he felt like, Big Brother was, stepping on his head. They were getting these threatening letters from, Trincaro in California that, oh, you can't use your name. Like, wait a second, it's my name. We've been selling wine, since the 20s. My grandfather and what do you mean I can't use this, but fortunately they were able to come to some kind of solution, but, it's a great and singular wine. I'm glad you really like that, Joe. I mean, most people don't think of Barbera that can age, but, this is really singular Barbera. I think what's interesting about him, too, he's a very close friend with Giampiero Bea. And to me, the wine is a lot like Bea Sagrantino. It's almost like, if Bea made Barbera, it would taste like Trincaro. And when you taste it, you really think about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. And if you look at we only have like 4 red magnums at Alta Linea, and it is Calabretta, Etna Rosso, Trincaro Barbera, and Paolo Bea Sagrantino 2007, which, by the way, if you find any around, that is like the greatest vintage of that wine ever. It's like way step up from the last 2 years. But it makes sense now that, that.
Yeah, when you really, you taste you this together. Similarity. There's a lovely rusticity to the wine. They age beautifully. The first time I tasted them, I met them in a restaurant. They had wines going back to the 70s. And we just started popping corks. And I'm like, what the hell is this stuff? Like, this is Barbera?
How often does that happen? Like, you're like, how does no one know about this? How has no one brought this in? I mean, I've heard this argument, and this will be the last question because we needed to wrap up, that all the great wines have been, have been brought in at this point, that there's so many importers and so many distributors around. Are you still able to find new producers that no one else is working with?
It's getting harder and harder because they're just like you say, there's lots of people, combing the territory and, you think you make a discovery and, the guy's like, oh yeah, I'm being brought in by Joe Blow Imports and he buys 10 cases a year. I'm like, well, we could buy more than 10 cases. And like, well, so we're represented. So there's lots of stuff that is taken, but there's still stuff to find. That's what's amazing about the wine business is you find these little diamonds in the rough and you bring them to people like you who get super excited and bring them to people. And that's, it's one of the great things about our business and the kind of wines that we sell.
Yeah. Well, I cannot agree anymore. Doug, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Joe, thank you so much. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And for all of you out there, if you see Planner Selections on the back label of a bottle, it will almost certainly be an excellent quality bottle of wine. It's something we work with his wines at all of the restaurants, and I'm proud to do so. I'd also like to thank Joy Morales and Jack Inslee, our producers for In the Drink, and all of you for listening. Thanks so much. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.